a bit more on her background. I was so impressed. She has three MAs, if I read it correctly. Don't know what one would do with all those, Jill. One PhD, fortunately. She received her PhD from the University of Chicago. She has taught at four different institutions, first at Xavier College in Chicago, then at the University of California, Riverside, where she initiated their program in religious studies. Then she taught from 1973 to 81, 8 years, at the Divinity School at Duke University, and finally has ended up at the University of Missouri in Columbia, where she is professor and chairwoman of the Department of Religious Studies. She has won numerous honors and has been asked and invited to give numerous lectures. And I was interested in a couple of the lectures that she has given. The one that interested me in particular was a lecture at Concordia Seminary on Luther's Haupt article. You can guess what that is. At St. Louis in 83. And also, she was the National Endowment for the Humanities lecturer on Luther's importance and the recent agreement on justification for a Luther symposium at Carroll College in Helena, Montana in 1983. So she got close to this area. She has written a number of books, many articles, and her credentials are impressive. She keeps herself active. Last week, she sponsored a symposium at the University of Missouri where the Secretary of Education, William Bennett, spoke. And I think if you were keeping up with your daily newspaper, you may have heard that he attempted to respond to a candidate by the name of Pat Robertson, who wanted to stamp his own brand of Christianity on our nation. Then she spent last weekend at a Lutheran Roman Catholic dialogue in West Virginia, and she has been for a number of years a member of the official dialogue team, and she brought her greetings from John Ruman to those of you who know him, and now she is with us. I'm glad she made it. She must leave Wednesday afternoon to see if her classes at the university still remember her. Her topic is religion and politics, certainly a pressing issue. And tonight she will talk about religion and politics in the 16th century. Let's give a warm hand to Professor Jill Thrupp.
Thank you very much, Walter. I'm very impressed. I'm also impressed to discover that I'm an angel. And I'm afraid I'm one with a cough, which is something new under the sun. And I hope it won't get in the way this evening at all. In fact, I'm just about impressed with everything to the degree that it's a difficulty that came upon people in the Middle Ages more often, but it's called ligature. It's a spiritual malady that prevents you from speaking. And I think Holden is enough to bring it on in some ways. I think I was just telling Walter that one's senses are bombarded here, and the kind of Vespers we just had, I thought all through them, this place spurs creativity. You look at the ceiling, you look at the crucifix and things that have been made by hand and the crafts and the indications of creativity everywhere here. And emphasis on the creator is pretty easy to come by. And then you come down out from dinner and find that the deer are greeting you on the lawn. And it's really quite impressive. And I think for the rest of you for whom this is the first time, you may be having a difficult moment sorting everything out. It comes at you so fast, and there is so much of it. So that by way of saying that it's a great pleasure to be with you all, and also to discover what a gung-ho group you are, and that you sing. A Catholic is always amazed at Lutheran singing. Would that we could do the same, but we never do. The dialogue, when it's the Catholics' morning for four services, we sing one hymn, one verse. The other morning, the Lutherans chose one with six. We did them all. And that's always a bit of a shock. So it is a great pleasure to be here. And what I want to do is to reflect on religion and politics in a way that's fairly new to me. I think we all need to reflect on it more and more. It's becoming evident that it's something we can't dodge. And it seemed to me that we should think about it and be able to enter into conversation about it with people and with congregations. And I'm sure you all have. Some of you probably will contribute more to this dialogue than I will. You may have thought a good deal more about it than I. But history tends to make one think about these things, and our own national situation now makes one think about these things also. One of the things I have to deal with students often enough is the notion that religion, as Mondale said, is between me and God. He was cheered when he said that. I'll come back to that quotation later. And it was very difficult to get students to think of religion, and I teach religious studies in an academic situation without pressing any particular religion, but just to get them to understand how a religion works. And I said, well, your religion is just between you and... Where did you get your religion? I read the Bible. Where'd you get the Bible? A store. Where do you think it came from? Just to get them to admit that there is a group of people that have something to do with the fact that they have some form of religion. Or reject any form of religion is a social event too. I said, what happens in funerals? Well, dying's a very private matter, of course, but burying people is not. And try to work with them. Americans are very jealous of the privacy of religion. So when preachers discuss politics, sometimes they're told not to do that. Stick to religion, stick to the spiritual, and so on. So, are religion and politics linked? And I have here in brackets, ask for a show of hands, but I'm not going to insult you like that now that I know what kind of people you are. I'll just go right on. Ought there to be linkage? That's a little bit more sophisticated question, whether there ought to be or not. Now, Reagan said yes, and Mondale said no. Now I'll ask you to show your hands. No, I won't. Well, the first question it asks about a fact, are they linked? The second asks about an ought they to be? But even the first question is quite complex, and we'll try to look at some of those complexities. We probably won't be able to answer the second entirely, whether it ought to be or not, or to what degree it should be. But that religion and politics are linked is undeniable. We just have to look at history a bit, and I thought I'd trot through some of it, or look at any part of the world today, Eastern, Mideastern, Western. I don't know if this is appropriate or not, but Fourth World. One of the things that we try to do in our religious studies department, one of the things that we have insisted upon from the beginning is to have a tribalist. I don't think people know anything about religion unless they also know about tribal forms of religion. Anyway, I call that the fourth world. I don't know if that's fair or not. There should be a better word. It's terribly hard to find a good word for tribal people because every word we have is derogatory. I don't know if you've noticed that. Primitive, uncivilized, unlettered, un-something, mostly. So, at any rate, in any part of the world we look at, we find religion and politics linked. Muslims, of course, will tell you that to try to separate them is insanity, that they are by nature linked. So, actually, it'll be in the next lecture that I talk more about 16th century. We're asked to give titles. Last March, sometime like that. And last March, I was thinking, next September, I don't know what I'm going to do next September. So I did put some titles in that I thought I could probably put most anything under. And even so, I've changed them a little, so they won't follow exactly that, but they won't be too far from it. And we will spend a little time in the Protestant Reformation, where I've spent a lot of time, and with a particular town and the people in that town, whom I've gotten to know pretty well through all kinds of documents, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about them. But before that, I would like to sort of go through history. But I want to do it looking at four things. Not the history, but also sociologically what's going on, some of the moral questions and a psychological question. Sometimes people think that the Christian church's involvement with politics began with Constantine. And of course, the relation of church to state became public and was bolstered by emperors appointing bishops, calling councils, suggesting answers to theological problems. If you remember, Constantine was one of those who helped solve the Trinitarian problem, building churches and having themselves depicted with the square halos that signify living saints. But were the previous centuries free of political entanglements in religious affairs? Think of the political maneuvering of the Pharisees and Sadducees in Jesus' time. Or more to the point, think of the trial of Jesus and the behavior of Herod and Pilate. We don't usually think of them from that angle, but that was certainly political maneuvering on the part of those two. If you remember why Herod sent Jesus to Pilate. And if you want to know more about politics in the New Testament, ask Walter Pilgrim, who spends his sabbatical looking into such matters. During the first centuries, insofar as Christians challenged the Roman pantheon, and particularly the deification of Roman emperors, they became subject to political persecution. Although Roman aristocrats regarded Christians as unwashed rabble, some at least considered Christians a threat to Roman traditions. But let us concede that the kind of political involvement we are talking about becomes particularly problematic when a church grows large enough to have political clout of its own. So there is no doubt that Constantine's legitimation of the Christian church gave it that sort of clout. From the time of Constantine, the empire co-opted the church until the tables were turned, as you well remember from your history lessons by Gregory VII, when he brought Emperor Henry IV to his knees at Canossa, you remember that. But the ensuing period of papal dominance lasted just a few centuries, and you remember it reached its apogee under Innocent III at the beginning of the 13th century, and plunged to a kind of nadir with the kidnapping of Boniface VIII by Philip the Fair in the beginning of the Babylonian captivity. That's the Babylonian captivity I know about. You know about a different one. So, and you know, if you enjoy good historical novels, Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose is all about the Pope-Emperor struggles in the 14th century. That's the background to The Name of the Rose. Does the emperor make the pope, or does the pope legitimate the emperor? Religion and politics were no less involved in the Protestant Reformation. Were it not for the protection of Duke Frederick, Luther's career might have ended abruptly before the Roman Curia, which probably would have burnt more than his books. And where would you all be? Had the Protestant princes not attended the Diet of Augsburg, indeed sat upon the committee that advised Philip Melanchthon, there would have been neither occasion nor opportunity for such a document as the Augsburg Confession. It was only the uncertain balance of Protestant and Roman Catholic princes that guaranteed Protestants some protection in the empire during the first half of the 16th century. You may say that protecting the Lutheran liberty to assemble and to teach was a legitimate duty of Protestant princes, but the princes went beyond protection. Many of those princes made very clear their theological preferences and hired and fired court theologians on the basis of those preferences. At the beginning of the second half of the 16th century, the Peace of Augsburg was signed, a peace that was constructed of a political-religious settlement, of a political-religious war. The Peace of Augsburg was taken by some Lutherans to sanction the persecution of Reformed and Anabaptists, but more of this later. As you know, the colonies that became the United States were not founded on the principle of religious freedom for all, but on the need of dissenters to establish their own brand of Protestantism, or in the case of Carolina, Roman Catholicism, without fear of persecution from the British crown. Once the colonists were settled, they often followed the European pattern of demanding religious conformity before allowing people to become voting citizens. Citizens were covenanted, and indeed, one of the more famous bits of colonial history has to do with the acceptance or not of the halfway covenanted. If we think such a base for enfranchisement odd, it's not so different from the political action groups that ask congressional candidates whether they have been born again, believe in heaven and hell, and then either support them or attempt to destroy them on the basis of their answers. In each of the periods of history that we've gone so briefly through, the equivalent of today's mass media were and are employed to persuade the people of the righteousness of the prevailing political religious situation or to bring about change. From graffiti on Roman walls to 16th century broadsides to TV spots, and from the public speeches of senators to the impassioned sermons of monks and TV evangelists, the messages of rulers, bishops, and dissidents find their way to the streets and shops of Christendom. People lined up on the side of Arius or Athanasius, Theodoric or Theodosius, iconoclasts or iconodules. And today, they rally around other slogans, the moral majority, the American way, whatever. Folk followed Peter Waldo into heresy or Francis of Assisi into sanctity. Monks like Bernard of Clairvaux preached crusades, urging princes to free the Holy Land. And Bernard, and I remember this because I want to come back to it. Bernard is one of the great spiritual leaders of all time, I suppose. He certainly has left an enormous impression on the development of spirituality. And he came in, after he preached that crusade, he found that some of the crusaders thought they'd practice up on the Rhineland Jews. Burning, pillaging, killing. And Bernard stopped them. Somebody said that's why Bernard has become a popular name amongst Jews. Bernard, we may think, was misled, perhaps, by politics, by the spirit of the time. But in this instance, he understood what was right and stopped the havoc that the Crusaders were beginning to wreak upon these people. Today, people who claim to be Christians, men like David Tate, who in my state killed a state trooper in Missouri, a neo-Nazi, appeal to desperate farmers to destroy the Jew bankers. Appeals in such graffiti papers, speeches, and sermons were prompted by many of the same concerns that are exploited by today's media: God, country, family. The same appeals were used in the 16th century in popular pamphlets, made still more graphic by cleverly drawn cartoons. You've seen them all in your textbooks, I'm sure. The Pope as an ass, and probably you haven't seen so many of Luther as a devil, but those existed too. No holds were barred, for even in those days of a slowly dying feudalism, the minds of the people were considered worth fighting for. I need not, I think, tell you a lot more about the link between preachers, politics, and propaganda in the 80s. We'll come back to that. The moral problem is one that runs throughout history, and that is that people are concerned about decency in human relations. And sometimes they carry that concern to a degree that begins to defeat the very purpose for which they say they're fighting. Like people in all ages, for instance, adherents of the moral majority want to see their values reflected broadly. To challenge those values seems to them a threat to their very identity, their place in the world, their sanity and safety. It is no wonder that these people and others fight, sometimes so bitterly they betray their own standards in defense of those standards. And we want to look at why. Throughout history, charges of immorality have accompanied efforts to pressure government to persecute forms of religion considered by whatever majority was at the time to be unacceptable. Aristocratic Romans valued the culture of the Roman Republic and valued its gods. To these people, Christians challenged those gods. Christians were to be persecuted. They were charged with crimes such as sexual orgies, incest, and ritual murder, and the eating of babies. I mean, that's in the documents. I'm reading it now with a class. You know that they put babies in a crust and the novices had to slice them and eat them. Wonderful. Historians looking for some reason for these accusations suggest that the Christian doctrine of mutual love gave rise to the sexual orgy charge, that incest entered because Christians called one another sister and brother, and the Eucharistic meal provided grounds for baby eating. That may be so, but they don't really need any excuses. Accusations of this kind recur with or without a basis in belief or ritual. In the Middle Ages, when Christians were in the majority, Jews were accused of ritually murdering children, as were witches and some heretics, and all were accused of sexual immorality and incest. It's just common. Once anyone has stepped sort of outside the ordinary, then it's considered that they must be extraordinary in every way, and all values are overturned, inverted. They walk on their heads. As most of you know, the 16th century Roman Catholic polemicist Cocleus began the slander that Luther's immorality, his uncontrollable lust, was the reason for his heresy. He was just another monk who couldn't keep his vows, so he invented a religion that had as its cornerstone a doctrine that made vows sinful. This slander is still believed in some pockets of hyper-conservative Roman Catholics. I remember arguing with a college classmate. I was a very ardent convert at that point. College classmate who wanted to become Lutheran, that Luther's language was so crude he could hardly be Christian. On the other side, Lutherans accused not only Catholics, but even more vehemently, you may be surprised to know, Calvinists of being devils, and consequently of heresy and immorality. What I'm really interested in discussing with you, and I mean discussing with you, not lecturing at you, is the psychological, but by that I really mean spiritual. And I'm not a psychologist, so I'm not going to be talking technically. But I want to try out a thesis that may stimulate some discussion and perhaps result in pastoral strategies which you as a group and individuals may devise and apply. So I want to spend a little more time on this point than history, sociology as such, in the way that I handled it, and morality. It has become widely recognized that the mix of religion and politics is particularly powerful, and in fact a powder cake. People have been willing to kill and to die for one or the other. And I should tell you the story of a teacher of church history told me. He got tired of teaching church history in the usual way, so he decided to teach it from the point of view of the heretics. I mean, he just taught the whole of Christian history from the point of view of various heresies, looking at those Christians. But anyway, that was interesting. But what he did was an experiment with the students, and he asked them, he gave them little pieces of paper, totally unmarked, and he said, all right, if you would die for your religion, write yes. And he collected them and he read them out, and there were maybe 3 that would die for their religion and about 15 that said, no way. And he passed them out and he said, how many of you would kill for your religion? And 10 would kill. I don't know where he was teaching. But if you bring religion and politics together, you really have something going, as in resurgent Islam, which I've been told to say is the correct way to speak about it. You've seen it in Lebanon. You've certainly seen Northern Ireland going on and on and on. And the result is a fanaticism. And why are these two areas of human life so explosive? Well, leaving aside politics for the moment, I'd like to just look at the religious side, and we can then perhaps apply some to the political. And I would like to look at the roots of religion, which I think is spirituality. And I'm going to define that in a very broad way, as the deepest personal appropriation of a religion's beliefs and practices in order to communicate or identify with the divine. That is, deepest personal appropriation of a religion's beliefs and practices in order to communicate or identify with the divine. So we go through these points. You can move back and forth with between religious and political points and counterpoints. First and most important, and in some sense all-encompassing, is that religion provides a people and individuals in the group with a profound identity. Religion, all the religions I have studied, construct and explain the cosmos. By so doing, the religion not only deals with the origins of everything and everybody, it evaluates everything and everybody in terms of their relation to the divine. Those most closely related are most valuable, and so on. Most creation stories explain human closeness to God by saying that some part of the divine being was shared with the first people. The divinity uses spit or breath to create people. They aren't always very proper creation stories. Some are much more improper than that, but nevertheless. You may know some of those. In the case of Genesis, as you know, well, God breathed into Adam and Eve, and the text says that God made them in the divine image and likeness, so they're very close to God. Adam proved his superiority to the animals by naming them. In more egalitarian religions, just to give a different sort, such as the American Indian, all living things, two-legged, four-legged, and winged, share equally in the Great Spirit and can therefore incarnate divinity. I think that's very interesting, that divinity can take the form of any living being. The Indian's cosmos is differently shaped and inhabited than is the cosmos of Christianity. Christianity supports a hierarchy in which human beings share divine life in a unique way. Indeed, divinity has condescended to draw humanity into a personal union, so close as to allow for the identity of one person in two natures, in Jesus Christ. The hierarchical universe, God, angels, humans, animals, plants, minerals, sets a precedent for other hierarchies of a socio-political nature, some of which we approve and some of which we may disapprove. And I think about that for a minute. We sometimes take so much for granted that the world is the way we see it, that we don't realize that other worlds exist in different shapes and ways for other people, and that the models for those different ways and shapes are their creation stories. I wish I had time to tell you the story of the Dogon of Africa, but if you can, read Conversations with Ogatomeli, and you'll find that this African tribe, it just blew me away, absolutely. African tribe, with no writing, nevertheless had a metaphysics as complex as Plato's, and a creation story that wove together, literally weaving was very important, the elements of life in the most extraordinary manner. So different from ours. Some areas that seem somewhat the same, but quite different. Extraordinarily coherent. Sorry about that. So, ours is hierarchical. And the biblical scholars among you would know that oh boy, the relation of this hierarchy to Mesopotamian stories. So in all religions, the conception of cosmic reality provides a pattern for social structures. Social structures provide the framework for creation stories. That's a chicken egg situation. If the society is hierarchical and even patriarchal, then the way the divinity relates to the people will be grasped only through the familiar hierarchical and patriarchal ways of patterning authority. The point that I want to stress here, if you got that at all through my coughing, however, is that through religion, a people find a secure place in the universe. That's the point. That religion structures the universe so that the people say, this is where we are in it, this is the way the universe looks to us, thank you very much. And they know where they are. They have a sense of belonging. They have a firm center that locates not only all of reality, but more specifically, this village, this town, this nation. Other peoples are then viewed from that secure place. The people can look out on the cosmos with a certain confidence that order prevails and that they are a part of that order. Disorder enters when something moves from its place in the cosmos, when one tribe threatens to take over another, when an unseasonable storm strikes, when monsters are born. When disorders like these threaten, they seem to interrupt the proper flow of nature or community, and the people become restless and search for reasons and scapegoats. God, of course, can't be responsible, unless, of course, there can be found some reason for divine anger. Since God is perfect, imperfection must come from creatures, but especially intelligent volitional creatures, in our case, angels and human beings. Prophets then exhort the people to one of two courses. Either examine your own behavior, see if you've yielded to foreign gods or mores, or are there other people causing trouble by dishonoring God and maybe tempting you to do the same? The story of the Hebrews sounds these notes over and over. Or as the Romans reasoned, the Christians angered the gods by refusing to worship them and by upsetting the political religious order which found a place among the gods for Caesar. St. Augustine wrote the City of God to answer these charges. What had really happened? Christians threatened the identity of the Roman aristocracy by challenging their cosmos. What else could the Romans do but throw the offending Christians to the lions or whatever else? But the Christians' own sense of identity, indeed of identification with their crucified and risen Savior, gave them a joy in death which their persecutors could not seem to find in life, and Christianity prevailed. When Christianity, approved by Emperor Constantine, became sovereign, it began to indulge in a complacency not unlike that of the Romans in their day. Thus, the history of Christianity, like that of other major religions, is a history of reforms. And so we have a cycle of reform in all institutions, but in religions particularly, and in especially in those that become established. And that's true of any human institution. It's what this history is one of change, of conservatives hanging on to a dream of a golden past, of radicals looking to a golden future. The two dreams merge in a time like the Reformation, when a golden past, the Apostolic Church, became a model for a golden future, which would embody those ideals. You can see subsequent series of reforms within Protestant groups, and even, rather recently, the Vatican II, the Roman Catholic Church, which now, within a few years of Vatican II, seems to need a very radical another reform. Today, our president looks to a golden past as a model for America's future. So, one of the things you can talk about is how far one can go along such a course. What ideals of the past can and ought to endure? Which belong to their own time? And which become ugly distortions? Which are debatable in any age? So, we've got several sources for explosive religious behavior. The first is external challenges to a particular view of reality, the origin, uses, and destiny of the cosmos, the world we construct and inhabit. Anybody challenges that, we feel very insecure. Second would be internal challenges, such as the following away from the truth, as understood by the majority, of some individual or group, which then are called heretics or something else. Three, this would be the most serious, the failure of the whole people to maintain the religious truths and values they inherited. But in this last instance, there's no longer any fire in the religion, and it is probably no longer capable of starting or sustaining either religious or political action, unless, of course, a prophet arises who fans the coals of belief, and then the cycle of reform begins again. The point of this part of my remarks is that one of the great goods a religion can do for its adherents is to provide them with an identity, but unless that identity is deep and firm, any challenge to it may provoke a hostile reaction. So is it any wonder that when the defense of a people's religion is coupled with the defense of their political national identity, the situation becomes explosive? Let us look again at the intertwining psychological forces. Both religion and nationality answer basic questions. Who are we? Who am I? Why are we here? You can think of catechism questions, and you can think of national questions of, you know, what country do I belong to, and so on. What have we to hope for? That's answered by religion, and it's answered by a nation. What are we to work for? How do we explain evil? You can think of other questions, probably. Those are questions people want answers for, and the more uncertain a time becomes, the more anxious they are to have answers to those questions. And when other groups or individuals live by different answers to these basic questions, the reaction of a challenged individual or nation is double: fear, and then there are only two reactions possible to fear: flight or fight. A third reaction, intelligent rather than instinctive, follows the route of inquiry, but that's possible only when the group or individual is sufficiently secure to entertain curiosity. And what allows for such security? And this is where the spirituality has to be really deep. And that's why I said, think about Bernard. Why could he act as he did with the Jews? Why can anyone respond non-belligerently in a time when their very identity is threatened? And I think it's a faith that is more than assent to doctrine, that is a very profound spirituality. That is a faith that doesn't say, I believe the world is such and such, and I believe that these doctrines are true, and you'd better believe them too. Because if you don't, I'm either going to run you out of town, or hang you from a tree, or at least make you so uncomfortable that you'll join up with us, the good, true, right people. What allows one to offer their beliefs to others without forcing them, and to survive when another group challenges those. And I think it's a faith that's truly in God and not in particular beliefs. Those follow. And I'm not saying one should give up one's particular beliefs, but one should not enforce them at the point of a gun. And what allows one not to do that, and I think it is real trust, which is such a good Lutheran virtue. So that's a kind of general thesis that I have been trying to work with, trying to work around. When I hit Bernard first, that's why I said, remember him. I said, uh-oh, here is a profoundly spiritual man who certainly trusted in God and who preached a crusade. Now, what am I going to do with this man who told, not only that, he wrote the rule for the Knights Templar. So what happens when you get an individual like that? And I thought, well, what was he really doing? He was trying to make the world a monastery. But when he saw the misbehavior of the crusaders, something else was at work with him, that these people deserve to be and to be what they are. And I'm not sure that's the whole answer, but I think it's worth thinking about. When a religion fosters fanaticism, a spiritual dimension is missing in the people. I think that's the bottom line. People who are fanatic must overcome the other belief or people. Their faith is not in the God who creates, but in a God who condemns. Such a God is created in their own political image, for their own political advantage. A spirituality which lets God be God is also content to let other people be themselves too. Perhaps it can even look on others as people from whom some wisdom might in fact be gained. At the same time, it shares what it is gladly. And I want to come back to these thoughts again in the next two lectures. And in the next lecture, what I'd like to do is look at some people, some folks who were caught up in what was going on in the religion and politics of the 16th century, some things that I've discovered that were, to me, just amazing. What little people thought was happening and what was really happening on the political level. And what I also hope is that we will be able to talk about these things, and I'm not looking for agreement with my thesis. If you disagree, or if you have other ideas about it, but what I would love to hear them, but mostly what I'd like to do is get some thought going on what makes a people able to regard a world that seems to be coming apart at the seams in many ways, and at a group of people in this country that are demanding that their form of Christianity become the religion of us all. I mean, they really do want to see people elected to Congress and judges put on the court who will put what they think is necessary, prayer in the schools and their kind of prayer, the kinds of religious points of view that they have, see them enforced throughout the country. And I think we have to be very alert to what's going on. I think Secretary Bennett's speech, which I don't think was reported very well, I've seen it in the New York Times and I've seen it elsewhere, and it didn't say what he said. And what he said was, we're pluralism. We're a pluralistic society. We must maintain that. And we must maintain it even for unbelievers. And he never said that Christians have some corner on morality, or that prayer should be taught in the schools, which is somewhat some of our reporters in Columbia, Missouri, reported him as saying. But that the First Amendment should be safeguarded, and that religion, that politicians should not be afraid to mention religion, which is kind of a no-no, actually today in many circles. Nor should religious people be afraid to speak of politics, but what we should all be afraid of is that any particular group do exactly what the First Amendment told us should never happen, and that is establish either a religion or a non-religion. Either one would be equally bad for this United States. So we want to be sensitive to those things, and I thank you for listening both to what I said and to my coughing. I hope we can have some good conversation about these issues, which are so important for us in these days. Thank you very much.
Since we will not have a fireside this evening, we thought we should give you a time to sleep. I'll suggest it to you at least. Why don't we just take a few moments here and entertain any questions that might arise from the group.
Unlike most speakers, I would entertain not only questions, but many speeches, if any of you have them to give. I think this is appropriate here. You know, they always say, please be sure your question is a question and not a statement. But since I am not here as an expert on this subject, church history, yes, but religion and politics is something I'm not sure there are too many experts around on, or maybe there are too many experts around. I'm not sure which way it goes. But I think really we need to talk about it amongst ourselves, and I think that probably many of you have things to say that are at least as illuminating and maybe more than what I have said. So if you want to make a statement, do that, as well as ask a question if you want. Anybody?
Would you mind stating your thesis again?
That what makes people fanatic, or what makes them so fearful of losing something they treasure that they're willing to hurt others, is a lack of really deep spirituality, of real trust in God. That's what it comes down to, I think. If you look at history or any other time, it's a fearful striking out at others who are challenging your world and your beliefs. The idea has error rights. You know, it hasn't had any rights until quite recently, and certainly in the medieval period. Error had no rights, and it's better to torture someone until they become a Christian, so you can send them to heaven as you kill them. These ideas, happily, are for the most part gone from most of us, but I think they are reemerging in some parts of the world. But what we're built on is that, well, you may agree or disagree that someone is either in error or in truth, but the individual has rights, regardless of that. And you don't lop off the heretic anymore to save the whole group. It doesn't work quite that way. I understand what they were trying to say throughout history, but I think we don't say that anymore. And I think we can afford not to say that. It's sort of the attitude of the Walter, the wonderful scholar, Gamaliel, who was it, who stood up and said, if this is to endure, it will endure. If it is of God, it will endure. If it's not of God, it'll pass of itself. Now that comes from a deep trust. You don't have to go out and kill all these Nazarenes, as the early Christians were called by the Jews. You don't have to go out and kill all the Nazarenes. If this Nazarene was from God, you can't destroy it. And if it isn't from God, it will destroy itself. That's a very sane point of view. Over here.
Would you apply this thesis to what we call political persecution? That it also is due to the lack of trust in God.
Oh, I think so. How many of you read a book that made such an impression on me a long time ago called, it was by Michael Harrington, called Other America? the other America. I think it ended up, if I remember it correctly, and I've always thought that these two things applied. I wasn't making connections between religion and politics then, but it seemed to me it was true both of politics and of religion, that the true citizen of the world or the true saint is one who knows where he or she lives, knows his or her identity as a Christian, as an American, as a Hindu, as a whatever, and yet can live comfortably with others in the world without having, I mean, you know who you are, but you don't have to demand that other people be the same as you. And if you remember that other America, there were rings of maturity as one moved out into the community of acceptance of other people. And the more you could accept, the more mature you really were, which makes most of our citizens and most of the world, I guess, haven't quite made it into full maturity. But full maturity for me has always meant sanctity in some fashion or another. So that you could let other people be who they are, listen to them, talk with them, and not feel that your very depths were shaken by the challenge that they presented. Nor did you have to refute them. You could offer what you had, and you could receive what they had to offer, and think about it, and maybe be wiser for it. But you weren't shaken, and you didn't feel you had to sock them in the jaw for being different. If that answers your question? Does it?
Yes.
Over here?
Yeah, I was just wondering, how would you define the words, and in particular the word politics?
The what?
The word politics.
Politics.
Because the domain of politics is not quite clear to me exactly where the limits are. And let me tell you why. A few weeks ago, I'm sure that many of the other pastors received a letter that tell your congregation that the members should vote for proposition number two. And I thought it was a good idea because I don't want to be against the poor people. But I was very uneasy with that because I didn't know whether I was now encased in politics. Or was I?
Oh, yes. You know, it's very hard to draw the limits. One of the things we'll be talking about in another lecture is, the letter that was sent out by Reagan to 80,000 Christian ministers. Dear minister, we're standing for your values. Vote for us. You didn't get that letter probably because they were mostly fundamentalists that were received it. Back there. Oh, that'd be fine. Yes.
One thing, and I'm not a proponent, but the thing that I get from fundamentalist friends would be in agreement with you about establishment of religion or non-religion, and what they're claiming is non-religion has been established. That's their feeling. Now, how do you counter, or how do you respond to that when their perception I agree with you. Can't establish that non-religion in America has been established, and that's what
they're valuing. Oh, it has been established. You mean secularism?
Right.
Oh, well, secularism is one thing, humanism is another.
I'm just saying that is their perception, so that they can agree with you in terms of what you're talking about in
establishment, but
just saying, and that's where we've
gotten off. Well, let me say something that Bennett said that I thought was impressive. Now, and I don't know that this is how many textbooks this has occurred, but insofar as either secularists or religionists distort historical documents or a balanced view, so far as it's possible to get, of history, I think that's reprehensible. And what Secretary Bennett told us about were some books in which pilgrims were called people who went on long trips. And a book which had a story by Singer in which the little hero thanked God, but in the book that was produced for the schools, he thanked goodness. That's a change in document. I mean, what Bennett was talking about then was the effort on the part of some to lean so far away from any kind of religion, and they're trying to keep from offending anybody. They're actually changing. I mean, they won't discuss that the colonies had anything to do with religion in their founding. But that's wrong. I mean, you can certainly teach children that the colonists came, many of them, the ones who weren't establishing penal colonies, because they wanted to practice their religion. That's a fact. And to distort that is wrong. And anyone who rewrites a textbook to hide that fact is not teaching the truth, and that's wrong to do that. And somebody asked Bennett, said, well, then what do you do in a classroom if the little kid comes up and says, well, should I believe in this God too? And they said, well, the teacher says, doesn't say yes or no. He says, discuss it with your parents. You know, discuss it that's not my job with you, but to tell you how this country was founded. If that interests you, then you can go see a church, a person in church, you can talk with your parents, you can talk with other people, but what I'm teaching you is what actually happened, and, you know, that can affect you one way or another. He's talking about little children, six, seven, eight years old. So I'm as opposed to the distortion of history or of documents in that way as to anything else. That is a kind of an establishment, I suppose. So, and some of the knee-jerk reaction to Bennett, I was really surprised. I thought his talk was, I said, it's just American. I didn't see it as Democrat or Republican. I was amazed. He mentioned Reagan once or twice, and that was about the only clue you had. Seemed right down the middle. And yet, because he was talking under the auspices of the Department of Religious Studies and as a paying lecturer in religion, the newscast that I heard the very next day was, Bennett tried to persuade, that's what he said, there were 1,000 people in the auditorium. He said, and this is what came out, Bennett tried to persuade about 250 people that religion should be taught in the schools. They had his lecture. They hadn't read it, or, what very often happens, they knew what he was going to say, didn't they? And so they heard him say it. And I thought, you know, and afterward, then Bennett told me a Pat Robertson story. I mean, he was sort of tired afterward, and he said, I already know what's out on AP. They want to know why I chose today, when Pat Robertson was doing his TV special, to attack him. And I said, for heaven's sake, we'd invited him last March, and we gave him the subject. But you see how it goes? So it's very difficult to be fair in these kinds of things. But I have seen enough and heard enough, whether pro or against Pat Robertson, of the efforts of Jesse Helms to impose their particular brand of belief on the rest of us. And that troubles me. And I don't want to see that happen. Now, somebody also asked Bennett, and I thought this was a good answer. They said, what would happen if Pat Robertson were elected? And I thought Bennett would say coolly, like a good politician, well, of course, that's in the future, and who knows, and we'll see what happens. He said, well, you know what I think will happen? And he'd been quoting all the fathers of the Constitution and of our country and so on all throughout his speech, and he did this again, and he said, I forget which of these wise fathers, he didn't quote any mothers, I'm sorry, said this, but that democratic institutions tend to moderate the positions of those who take power. And he said, I'm sure that if Robertson were elected, by the time he were elected, many of his positions would have to be moderated for him to appeal to a general electorate. And what's more, if he became president, since he would have to deal with Congress and so on, many of his harsher or less acceptable to many of the citizens, those positions would have to be moderated as well. So that probably is what would happen if should he be elected.